It's time for Free Thought Radio, a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, www.ffrf.org, with your hosts, FFRF co-presidents Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor, with irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Godless ones, you heathens and hellbound atheists, and it's a good Saturday since Good Friday is over. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. This is Free Thought Radio. We have an hour devoted to slightly irreverent views, news, features, and music.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. Actually, do you know what they called the Saturday after Good Friday?
No.
Did you know that? According to many Christian traditions, it was called Black Sabbath. Because the disciples were so sad that Jesus has died and he hadn't resurrected yet, so it was called the Black Sabbath. But for us freethinkers, it's a good Sabbath, a good Saturday.
Because we know there was no such myth.
Well, exactly. Springtime. Free Thought Radio is brought to you by a non-faith-based initiative, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're the largest organization of atheists and agnostics in the country. We have almost 10,000 members now. And growing fast, free thinkers are people who are free from religion. And last week, if you remember the interview we had, we talked about the Christian Science religion a little bit and their religious exemptions from health care for children. Well, that reminded me of a joke that I used to tell when I was a minister. I used to preach for a long time, I'm embarrassed to say. But one of the jokes I used to tell is this. There was a Roman Catholic and a Southern Baptist and a Christian Scientist in hell. And the Roman Catholic was saying, "Oh, if only I had done more Hail Marys and prayed the rosary more, and if only I had worshipped the saints and gone to Mass more, I wouldn't be here today." And the Southern Baptist is saying, "Oh, if only I had gone to more Bible studies and prayer meetings and confessed my sins and sung more hymns to Jesus, I wouldn't be here today." And the Christian Scientist says, "I'm not here. I'm not here."
Well, it's a religion of denial. Today's guest will be secular lobbyist Laurie Lipman Brown, who's the first secular lobbyist of the 21st century anyway, working with the Secular Coalition of America, of which the Freedom From Religion Foundation is a member organization. And today's Free Thought Radio will also feature a pagan pulpit on Easter.
There's a lot of developments on the state church front. So first, let's go to some news about that battle of church and state.
We got to fight the battle of church and state. Church and state. Church and state. We got to fight the battle of church and state. Over the wall come a tumbling down.
Well, first I would have bragging rights, I guess. Would like to reminisce a little bit about Good Friday, because the Freedom From Religion Foundation brought the lawsuit in 1996, which overturned Good Friday as a state holiday in the state of Wisconsin. The state statute that was adopted at the after World War II actually mandated that all citizens had to worship in Wisconsin between particular hours on Good Friday.
After noon, right?
Yeah, well, they changed the hours, and it turned out to be that everyone got a half holiday if you were a state worker.
And the libraries were closed, and state offices were closed.
That's right. The libraries were closed, state offices. You couldn't conduct city business. And one Good Friday, Dan and I remember this, we took a camera, and we took photographs. I mean, it was almost humorous. Of all of the poor patrons of the various libraries in town who would walk up in the afternoon on Good Friday and encounter locked doors.
Well, students over at the Memorial Library, yes, with their notes under their arm.
They were really mad about it. And this was something that we got more complaints about than anything else in terms of state church violations in the state of Wisconsin. And we took that lawsuit in federal court. When we took it, it was under Governor Tommy Thompson, and he vowed in his State of the State address that he would fight our lawsuit all the way to the Supreme Court. Well, guess what? When we won before Judge Shabazz, a former colleague of Governor Thompson, it was not appealed. It was not appealed for the very good reason that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, which would be ruling on our case, had already ruled that Good Friday was not an appropriate government holiday in the state of Illinois. So it was sort of a no-brainer by the time we took it.
So this is the 10th year of...
Yes, but the really humorous part of that lawsuit was that the state, now Governor Doyle, was Attorney General. And to his great credit and integrity, he refused to defend our lawsuit. He said that the state would lose it.
To defend the state.
To defend the state. Yeah. He wouldn't represent Governor Thompson. So Governor Thompson hired some fat cat attorneys in Milwaukee, private attorneys, and they made the most preposterous claims that Good Friday was really like a secular holiday that people celebrated. Because, after all, we have Easter bunnies. Well, you know, this was something that was very easy for our attorney to shoot down, because Good Friday is not a fun holiday. There's nothing to do with bunnies or eggs or anything. It's celebrating, really, the death, marking the death of a deity. And so that was a very satisfying victory to take, because we could benefit from it. We could all go to the libraries and make sure that public government offices were open.
So if you, who are listening to this program, happened to be at the city library yesterday or at the Memorial University Library working or studying, you can truly give thanks to the Constitution for that freedom that is still open to all of us. And Annie Laurie, speaking of lawsuits, that was 10 years ago, and that was a nice victory, but we keep going on. We have a new lawsuit to report now, and you've been leading on this one, so tell us about it.
We have another faith-based lawsuit that we will be filing. I'm not sure if it's filed yet, but it will be any minute now in the state of Indiana. And what that state has done is its Department of Health and Human Services has hired a chaplain, a minister, a reverend. They had a religious test for this public office to minister to employees of the Department of Health and Human Services in the state of Indiana. So this is sort of a new development, a new twist.
So they have to be a clergy to get that position.
And he's supposed to minister to state employees, and he's supposed to recruit other ministers to be volunteers to do the same thing all around the state. We think it's a very strong lawsuit. We expect to get somewhere with it.
What are we asking for?
Well, we're asking, of course, for it to be found unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And it will have application in other states and other violations. So we'll keep you posted on that. There's also a development in the Freedom From Religion Foundation's nationally watched federal lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Prison. And we've sued a year ago in May when the Federal Bureau of Prison announced that it was going to take applications for, it was seeking grants, organizations that would like to offer single faith prison pods in its federal penitentiaries. And they told the Washington Post, for example, in one federal prison, we might have a Roman Catholic program, in another, we might have a Southern Baptist, and so on. When we heard about that, the Freedom From Religion Foundation immediately filed a lawsuit. And a few days later, the Federal Bureau of Prison quietly put up on their website that they had suspended calls for programs
for single faith. Yeah.
And then also very quietly in October, they canceled their programs. But they kept saying to the media, we were going to maybe do something different. So what we did is we didn't drop our lawsuit. It's in limbo. It's not in the calendar, but we can resume the case at any time. And we've been waiting to see what the Federal Bureau of Prisons is going to do. Well, late in March, the Federal Bureau of Prisons very quietly again put up on their website a pre-solicitation notice saying that they are now seeking pilot programs in which private operators will provide training to prisoners, including, they may do so, from a faith-based or religious perspective, although they may choose not to do so. If they choose to have a religious perspective, they also have to provide a secular alternative. Well, this is an improvement, but we still regard setting up a faith-based pod in a federal penitentiary with tax dollars to be an endorsement of religion. But what we have to do now is wait to see which applications are accepted and which programs they set up.
So you can see what they're trying to do is how close to the constitutional line can they get. They're trying to make it constitutional and still be allowed to have faith in the prisons.
And the faith-based funding flood continues. The news is just unabating. And Dan, you have some information about the new grants that have come down for the capital, what they call the Compassion Capital Fund.
This new round of federal faith grants. Now in its sixth year, and I'm reading from Free Thought today, the April issue. Now in its sixth year, the Federal Compassion Capital Fund, the CCF, is awarding $16.5 million in grants to strengthen the ability of smaller faith-based and community groups to deliver government social services. Announced by the Department of Health and Human Services in March, the grants will go to intermediary organizations, which in turn award sub-grants to train faith-based and community groups how to develop leadership, organization skills, revenue strategies, program management, and community involvement techniques. Their goal is not to serve the needy, but to deliver capacity-building skills to faith-based groups. Last year, for example, Pat Robertson's charity, Operation Blessing, there's a misnomer for you, allegedly redirected more than $500,000 in CCF grants to smaller faith-based and community groups to buy computers, tracking software, and refrigerated walk-in boxes and trailers. What is that?
Well, it's for the distribution of food eventually.
Oh, okay. It also sponsored technical assistance and grant writing workshops. HHS this year expects to give 33 demonstration program grants to new intermediaries for projects lasting 3 years. The ceiling is $500,000 per year to each organization. In the fiscal year 2002, when CCF began, it appropriated $30 million. In total, CCF has received $64.3 million in funding.
So that's just one program within Health and Human Services. And if you paid attention to what Dan was saying, you'll notice that what they're giving is money for capacity building for faith-based groups. It's all internal. It's all to help a group grow and thrive, not to help the needy, not to give money. And to give you an idea of how that gets interpreted, there was a lawsuit filed by Americans United for Separation of Church and State last year, and it got thrown out in late March. And what it involved was a faith-based marriage education program in Vancouver, Washington. And the judge, District Judge Franklin D. Burgess, ruled on March 20th in the lawsuit that the grants through the Capital Compassion Fund to Northwest Marriage Institute was acceptable because they stopped offering Bible-based workshops fairly recently. What happened is they've gotten more than $346,000 in federal funding, and they started getting that 3 years ago. And for 2 years, they continued to offer Bible-based workshops, but they discontinued them last April. And Americans United pointed this out, that they were getting federal funding while their whole workshop was based on the Bible. And the judge said because they discontinued it, that was all right. Americans United also pointed out that they were getting money to buy computers and that their computers promoted both religion and secular things and that their website is still all religious. And the judge said that's okay too because they used capacity building funding. So what our tax dollars are going for is simply to enrich the coffers of religious groups.
You would think that these charities are supposedly already in existence. They're already running themselves. They already have the capacity to do their work. And then, faith-based money was supposed to help them. But now we're actually building those very organizations.
We're in building faith-based bureaucracies, both in the government and privately. And what gets me is that they claim to offer free Bible-based premarital and marriage workshops. It's hardly free to taxpayers. So that's what's going on with your public dollars. Also, the White House is holding a series of presentations to tout the faith-based initiative. They held one in March, called Compassion in Action. And at the conference they held in March, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao said that faith groups are unique and valuable in providing prisoner reentry services, and she said that they have integrated the faith-based initiative into every single level of the Department of Labor. So the faith-based initiative continues unabated, and we will try to be taking more lawsuits to do something about that.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. We'll be right back to talk about our woman in Congress and what is being done by secularists to try to plug that big hole in the wall of separation between church and state. So stay tuned. Free Thought Radio is back. I'm Dan Barker here with Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we have on the phone today Lori Lipman Brown. Lori Lipman Brown is an attorney. She's also a former member of the Nevada State House. And she is now the director of the Secular Coalition of America. We spoke with Lori last June, so there's a lot of water under the bridge since that time and a lot to catch up on. Lori, good to have you here today.
Thanks for having me on.
We saw you in D.C. A few weeks ago for our Supreme Court case where you we had to miss your speech because we were inside the Supreme Court, but you were out there rallying for the troops. So
yes, I was trying to actually tell people what was really happening with faith-based initiatives as opposed to what the extreme right was telling them.
So the first thing, the really hot news right now is, everyone probably knows about this, but it was the Secular Coalition of America that broke the story about United States Representative Pete Stark being an unbeliever. So how did all that come about?
It was really wonderful. One of our advisory board members, David Niosi, suggested that when we looked at these surveys that showed that the majority of Americans wouldn't vote for an otherwise qualified candidate for office, at least for president, if they knew that person didn't believe in God, and that we were the most mistrusted minority in the entire nation, he said, well, why don't we find out if this is keeping people from winning elected office just based on their beliefs? I mean, in the entire population, approximately 10% of us are non-theistic. So, you know, is that our distribution in elected office? And when we started this competition, we asked people, who do you think is the highest level elected official? And we'll ask the folks you nominate and see if any of them both are and are willing to say that publicly without having their arms twisted.
Did anybody nominate George Bush?
I have to say we will not disclose the names of any nominees except the ones who said it was okay to disclose their names.
So it is possible.
It is possible.
So somebody put forth Representative Pete Stark's name then?
Yes. And when we approached the people who were nominated, we gave them three different choices. It wasn't just, are you theist or non-theist? The third choice was, I'd prefer not to say. So we, you know, we didn't want to put anyone on the spot, especially given those survey results. You know, it could mean the difference between serving their constituents well or just being upfront about their beliefs. And Representative Stark was very matter-of-fact about saying, well, yeah, I'm a Unitarian, and I don't have any beliefs in a supreme being, and I'm willing to have you tell the world that. That's not a problem. I've never really thought of it as an issue. But then he also is very strong on the importance of separation of church and state, as are a lot of religious people.
We've noticed that in his voting record, that he's been very strong on the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, he was one of those who refused to go out and shout under God in the Pledge of Allegiance and didn't vote to chide the Ninth Circuit on their decision on that. And, of course, he and George Miller asked the GAO, the Government Accountability Organization, to do a report on the faith-based initiative that came out last year.
And the early one just basically showed there was no accountability, from what we understand, but they're going to be Well, we're working with their office as well as a number of other offices to try to get some kind of accounting for where the money went, how it was distributed, what they're doing with it. Last year, David Kuo wrote quite an expose about that Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. And if half of the things in his book are true, these grant-making decisions were based on whether or not someone applying for the grant was Christian. I mean, it was really bad, and then absolutely no accounting at all for what happened to the money after that.
So you're trying to plant the idea that we need to get some congressional investigations into the faith-based initiative.
Oh, yes. And, of course, this Congress has a lot of investigations on their plate.
Right.
And I understand that some of them, you know, are much more immediate needs. But eventually we have to look at how our tax dollars are being diverted to religious organizations, and perhaps they're proselytizing, perhaps they're abuse of the money. We have no idea of knowing because no one looks at what happens to it.
Until somebody like us takes a particular lawsuit and scratches beneath the surface. And,
exactly.
And finds out.
But we won't know what happens with our challenge, for example, of the Centers of Faith-Based Initiative at the White House and at the cabinets. But Congress could defund them,
even if
the courts say it's okay for Bush to do this. So we certainly hope there'll be more pressure, you know, on Congress to look into this.
It's always a good strategy to have both the legislative and the congressional branches being approached on it. And it's not just Secular Coalition for America that's really pushing for accountability and oversight of the faith-based initiatives. There are dozens of organizations with us on this one.
Religious groups too, right?
Yes, yeah. Baptist Joint Committee, Interfaith Alliance, a whole slew of
American Jewish Committee.
American Jewish Committee, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. You know.
Now, you're in Washington, D.C. You're the first full-time secular lobbyist. Is that true, as far as you know?
The first congressional paid lobbyist explicitly representing non-theistic Americans.
So you've been in Stark's office and many offices there in Congress.
Yes. In fact, Stark was one of only seven members of Congress to vote against continued funding of the Boy Scouts of America while they continue to discriminate against atheists. And, of course, they discriminate also against gays, but the part that's illegal is the part where they engage in religious discrimination. So he was one of the first people we visited because when you only have seven that are with you on everything, you say hello to them early on.
Are there going to be others coming out? Other revelations of non-theistic members of Congress?
We already have a state senator, Ernie Chambers, who won an award from Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Yeah.
Did he fill out one of your applications?
He gave us his yes, and you may tell people about 4 days after the press release, although we had contacted his office many times right up to the moment we sent the press release because we really wanted him in the mix. It certainly helps to have someone between a Congress member and a school board.
Yes, and
the diversity of having an African-American in the mix. So many people don't equate the possibility that a person of color could also be a non-theist.
And Ernie Chambers, of course, has just been so great on state church issues.
And plus he's from a red state, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took that famous lawsuit trying to stop the chaplains in the legislature.
Marsh versus Chambers, and he ended up stopping them other ways in his state, even though he lost that. So
right.
That's good to know, because when I met him in person and asked him, gee, should I call you, how should I introduce you, he was a little coy.
Uh-huh.
So he agreed to non-superstitionist.
Hmm.
Well, even Representative Stark doesn't identify with the word atheist.
Right.
But he says, yes, I'm a Unitarian who doesn't believe in a supreme being.
And some Unitarians do and some don't, right?
Right.
And there are other Unitarians in Congress, and there are other members of Congress who are unaffiliated.
There are 12. Now, they use the term unaffiliated in a lot of the reports, but when I look at the congressional bios, these are 12 individuals or about a dozen individuals who just have not stated next to religion. Because when I think of unaffiliated, it might just mean, oh, I don't belong to a particular church. But when someone doesn't state, doesn't fill that in, I think they really respect that's not an appropriate question for congressional bio. And informally, we've looked more into those folks' background, and most of them are religious, but they understand it's just not an appropriate thing to be wearing on their
sleeve. Or they're just not ready to make a public statement.
Oh, that could be.
But, well, now we had some good news recently, something that you had lobbied on, which was an amendment to allow religious discrimination at Head Start, failed in committee.
Yes, that was so exciting. There was actually applause in the committee room, and you never hear that, because I've only been doing this for a year and a half. So I was there last year when that amendment that would allow religious discrimination in hiring and firing of Head Start teachers, when that did pass the House and then it was stopped in the Senate. But there were people who work on this issue who'd been there since they started pushing this in 2003, and every time it was raised, the House passed it. Well, this time it went down in committee. So we're likely to see someone bring it up on the whole floor of the House, but we're not concerned that it would pass. We're just touching base with a lot of the newer members to make sure they understand the issue.
Well, that's a good sign. And which committee was that?
That went in the Education Committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will be right back after this short break to continue talking with Lori Lipman Brown, who is our secular lobbyist in Washington, D.C.
Our woman in Congress. We'll be right back. Free Thought Radio is back. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are on the phone with our guest, Lori Lipman Brown in Washington, D.C. She's a lobbyist and a director of the Secular Coalition of America. And by the way, the Secular Coalition is an organization of member organizations, and the Freedom from Religion Foundation is proud to be a part of that. Can you explain real briefly about the Secular Coalition, Lori?
Sure. Way back in 2002, the president, Herb Silverman, was noticing the unbelievable religiosity and the push to claim God for the whole country after the attacks of 9/11. So he got whatever non-theistic organizations nationwide he could to come together to hire a lobbyist to actually have a voice in Congress. And at that time, there were four member groups, and now, having added wonderful groups like yours, we have eight member groups, and they're all listed on secular.org, which is our website.
And a lot of our members are so happy to think that now we actually have a presence. We actually can say something in Congress. What are some of the issues you've been talking about in the halls of Congress the last month or two?
Well, in addition to military proselytizing and Head Start discrimination and faith-based initiatives, there are two bills that the Secular Coalition for America is attacking pretty much on our own. This one we're not doing with large coalitions. But they're bills that, well, they're laws that have been on the books for a while, and people don't necessarily realize how terribly they're being abused. They privilege a certain religion over other religions and the non-religious. One of them has been on the books since 1993, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it basically says, even if there isn't any compelling state interest in keeping a certain religious person from doing a certain act, they can keep you from doing that same act. So it results in, for example, a religious group can use hallucinogenic tea, but a woman who's dying of cancer and in terrible pain can't use medical marijuana. You know, those sort of inequities. And then the other one has to do with zoning and land use, where it's called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. That was passed in 2000, and it pretty much is letting these mega churches just take small counties and large counties, for that matter, to court all over the country, claiming they don't have to follow any zoning or land use regulations.
Now, the original Religious Land Use Act was, I think it was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court in the Byrne case in Texas, was overturned.
It was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in the Byrne case. Yeah, that the reason they passed the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act was to try to remedy the parts that Bernie said didn't apply, that it wouldn't apply to the states and localities.
So I think there's probably court cases wending their way up the courts on that.
There are, and the really frustrating part of that is what the law does is it changes the legal standard. So it's a catch-22, because sometimes we'll go into an office to lobby about it, and they'll say, well, we should wait until these cases are done. Well, every case that comes before the court has to follow this other standard, and the whole idea is that's not the standard that should be used. So it's really quite a catch-22.
So, in other words, churches that are ringing bells 24 hours a day, for example, might be able to cite some of this language
to get around,
to get around city ordinances. Or
well, there's actually a so-called church up in Albany, New York, that is it looks like a nightclub, and it's the end of a local street, a residential street, and it's claiming that when it has punk rock concerts that it charges people to get into on at night, late at night, that they shouldn't have to get a use permit or a noise permit or anything.
On religious grounds.
So it's kind of carte blanche for anybody declaring a religious.
And I'm not saying that they're going to win cases like that, but these cases are going on all over the country, and these religious organizations are claiming that it's because of this law, RLUIPA, that they can say they don't have to follow these rules.
So when you say that the Secular Coalition is kind of going at it alone, you're saying that some of your usual comrades are not.
Yeah, some of our usual allies helped enact these bills, and in fact, one of our coalition members, the American Humanist Association, had originally thought they seemed like pretty good laws. It's only after watching how they've been abused since they've been put on the books that American Humanist Association has changed its view on this. And the county of Boulder has it the worst. In Boulder, Colorado, it's this mega church that's already gotten 5 zoning variances is using RLUIPA to sue because the county won't give them a 6th variance to double in size.
Wow.
I mean, it's just outrageous what they feel it allows them to do.
I was just thinking, if somebody needs medical marijuana, aren't there religions that use marijuana? Couldn't somebody join
Rastafarian?
There was a case recently, and it was shortly after these two decisions, the one allowing the UDV church to use hallucinogenic tea and the one not allowing the woman with cancer to use medical marijuana, that a church started that said that use of marijuana was part of its religion. And the court held that it didn't feel that was a sincere religion.
Oh, and virgin births are sincere, but
right, and so it also gets the courts more involved in deciding what is a sincere religion and what isn't, and it's really horrendous.
Now to switch topics, I think that you've also been involved in some of this, the big issue lately of the revelations of the proselytizing in the military.
Oh, that was so disturbing. I actually have a good friend who I've known since my time in Nevada who worked as a military chaplain. She's an Episcopal priest. When she came back, she was appalled by what some of the born-again evangelicals were doing over there. These are chaplains who are supposed to go overseas or wherever to accommodate the free exercise needs of the soldiers. But these born-agains are claiming that they're there to exercise their own religious exercise, not to accommodate the soldiers. And therefore, since their religion believes they have to convert everyone to be a born-again Christian, that they should be allowed to try to do that with every soldier who doesn't want to hear from them and on the government dime.
And what about some of the revelations, you know, like what the Christian embassy is doing in the Pentagon? Have you gotten involved in that?
Well, not as much, but it's the same kind of thing where they take the free exercise clause and just absolutely twist it.
To establish religion.
To say it means I get to impose my religion on you on the government dime.
And how does that differ from a high school teacher, let's say, claiming their free exercise rights to preach in the classroom? They're hired by the government to do a particular job.
Exactly. I mean, these folks, obviously, there's not a court in the world that would say that the free exercise clause means that you ignore the establishment clause and allow government funds to be used to prefer your religion on everyone else. But they like to claim that anyone who's trying to stop them from imposing their religion in governmental entities is trying to, you know, quash their religious exercise.
Now, in as your job as a secular lobbyist, I imagine that you would be encouraging regular citizens who are visiting Washington, D.C., to, when they visit members of Congress, their members of Congress, to identify themselves as being non-religious and being concerned about representation. Is that right?
Absolutely. Also, when people contact their representatives on issues, for example, on secular.org, we have a link where you sign up and you get e-alerts when an issue of particular interest is coming before a certain committee, and then you're asked, okay, if you're in this person's district, please contact them because this vote is coming up. Well, when you contact them, we give you an email sample that you can use. And I've actually had some of our theistic allies write to me and say, well, in your e-sample, it says I'm a non-theistic American. Well, but I'm not. And I just write back, well, then don't put that into yours, you know, adapt it. But what we want to do is show how those of us who are a member of this particular minority, and I also have people who say, well, I want to say I'm an atheist. I don't want to say I'm a non-theist. And I say, great, say that. But we want some way for the person receiving that information to know that we're their constituents, that they represent us and we're out there and we're good patriotic citizens who pay attention to the process and care about separation of church and state.
One of the newest members of the coalition is the Military Association of Freethinkers as well. So
yes,
there is a connection between the military and free thought.
Well, absolutely. And it seems to me that Congress has just not begun to catch up with the changing demographics of the growing number of people who reject religion who are willing to speak out in America. I mean, whether it's 10%, 14%, depending on the surveys or polls, that's an enormous minority compared to many religious minorities that are highly respected, such as Jewish or Muslim.
And I think that has a lot to do with the unwarranted amount of power that the hyper-religious neocons or whatever that they have had in our government. I mean, the executive branch walked in and said, I have a mandate. Yeah, the majority of people didn't vote for me, but I have this mandate to do what my God is telling me to do and to impose religion on the whole world and especially on every American. And it's like swept over us. But that's changing. I really do believe that the anti-church state separation folks went way too far when they attacked medical research with embryonic stem cells and the Terri Schiavo case. I mean, I think they just got to the point where
they scared us too much.
Yeah, and not just us non-theists. They scared religious people who went, whoa, that's not what I mean by religion.
Well, it's high time for a backlash, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Secular Coalition has a great webpage. It's secular.org, right?
Yes.
And what will people find if they go to secular.org?
Well, one of the nice things is there are links to all eight of our groups, including the military group, if you're a veteran or an active military person, and other groups like your own. The front page, you'll see information about Pete Stark making his announcement and a whole bunch of media that we got from that. But there's also an activist page that where you can look at what we've done archived, but also any current things that are still going that you might write about.
Well, thank you so much, Laurie. We're out of time, but we encourage people to look up the Secular Coalition.
Thanks.
You are listening to Free Thought Radio, hosted by Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor, and produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org.
Free Thought Radio is back. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor here with Dan Barker, and we're going to play one of our very favorite Free Thought songs. It's a literary parody called Fleas, kind of similar to trees. The lyrics are by poet Philip Appleman, and it's performed by Dan Barker on the piano.
I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord,
do all these things. I think that I shall never see a poem as ugly as a flea. A flea whose hungry mouth is pressed against a buttock or a breast. A flea that spreads disease all day and lifts its little claws to prey. Poems are made by you and me, but only God can make a flea. I think that no one ever made a poem as powerful as AIDS, or plagues that may in summer kill half the bishops in Brazil, and share the good Lord's final answer with clots and cholera and cancer. For God concocted pox to mock us, staph and syph and streptococcus. Poems are made by bards or hacks, but only God makes cardiacs. I think that I shall never smell a poem as pungent as a hell, where grinning devils turn the screws on saintly Sikhs and upright Jews, giving them the holy scorcher, timeless, transcendental torture. Poems can make you want to yell, but only God can give you hell.
That was Fleas, words by Philip Appleman, performed by Dan Barker, to the traditional music usually used to sing the poem, Trees. And who's that by again, Dan?
The songwriter is Oscar Rasbach. And, of course, Joyce Kilmer wrote the poem, Trees, that Oscar set to music. So this is a parody.
Yeah. A very clever parody. And it can be found on the CD Beware of Dogma by FFRF.org. And now, a free thought sermon.
And now for Free Thought Radio's Pagan Pulpit, featuring the ex-Reverend Dan Barker, author of Losing Faith in Faith, From Preacher to Atheist, and co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation.
Tomorrow is Easter Sunday, and as believers are sitting in their pews listening to the resurrection story, I have a question for them. Exactly what happened on Easter Sunday? I want to challenge Christians not to prove the story, but simply to tell the story. In each of the four Gospels, begin at Easter morning and read to the end of the book. Also read the first chapter of Acts and Paul's tiny version in 1 Corinthians. Then, without omitting a single detail, write a simple chronological narrative of the events between the resurrection and the ascension. Thomas Paine tried to do this 2 centuries ago in The Age of Reason, and he failed. I tried the same thing myself. The first problem I found is in Matthew, When two women arrive at the tomb, quote, "And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it." Notice, the stone was moved after they arrived, yet Mark, Luke, and John say it happened before they arrived, also neglecting to mention this great earthquake. Matthew then places the first appearance of Jesus on a mountain in Galilee, as predicted by the angel. Mark repeats that message, but tells another story of the appearance. Luke gives a different angelic message and locates the first appearance to two men on the road to Emmaus, and then later to 11 disciples in Jerusalem. John reports a radically different angelic message and says that the appearance happened that evening in a room to 10 disciples. These details are impossible to reconcile. Galilee is 60 to 100 miles north of Jerusalem. Did they all dash up there and then back home in time for dinner on foot? There's no mention of any horses, but a dozen thoroughbreds would need about 5 hours for that trip at breakneck speed without a rest. And during this madcap race, could Jesus have found time for a leisurely stroll to Emmaus for a different dinner? Here are a few more unanswerable questions. Who were the women? What time did they visit the tomb? What was their purpose? Who was at the tomb? One angel on the stone? One young man sitting inside? Two men standing inside? Or two angels sitting on each end of the bed? Did the women tell what happened? When Mary first saw Jesus, when she returned, did she know that he had been resurrected? Could Jesus be touched? What happened at the appearances? Did Jesus stay on earth for a while? Did the ascension take place in Jerusalem, Bethany, or on the Mount of Olives? And why do Matthew, John, and Paul not mention the ascension at all? I could make this a harder challenge. I could ask why stories of people materializing out of thin air, thousands of corpses crawling out of their graves, walking through doors and levitating, should be given serious consideration at all. Why should modern Christians be more eager to believe than doubting Thomas, who lived during that time, or the other disciples who admitted that the women's report, quote, seemed to them as idle tales, and they believed them not? But first things first, Christians, either tell me exactly what happened on Easter Sunday, or let's leave the Jesus myth buried next to the pagan goddess of spring, Easter, who's also called Ishtar and Astarte, after whom this natural holiday was named.
And that concludes today's show.
I'm Dan Barker with co-host Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio, produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. The program can be heard at ffrf.org, where all of our past shows are archived and podcasts. Email us at freethoughtradio@ffrf.org. Phone us at 608-663-7291 if you want to make a comment or ask a question that we can address on the air. That's 608-663-7291.
Thanks for listening.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday